You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 27. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'll be your host today. And today we're talking about Central Plains archaeology, plain and simple. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge the Nooch, or Ute peoples, on whose treaty lands I'm recording today, as well as the fact that this area is also part of the Dene Ta in the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Today we have Carlton Shield Chief Gover on the show. Carlton is a PhD student in anthropology at the University of Colorado Boulder and a member of the Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma. He has a master's in anthropology from the University of Wyoming and a bachelor's of science in anthropology from Radford University. His primary research interests include protohistoric and historic Pawnee and Arikara archaeology and Bayesian statistical analysis of Central Plains radiocarbon record. He is currently the board secretary of the Pawnee Nation Museum and has a range of experience across academia, CRM, and public archaeology organizations. So welcome to the show, Carlton.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right. So I really want to jump in. I'm really curious for you how you got into this field and what got you interested in this kind of work.
Oh, absolutely. It started probably when I was in middle school. After my parents separated, my father moved out west. He worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and he was the superintendent for Wind River Indian Reservation. So when we visited and lived with my father out in Wyoming, he'd often have us just go out with some of his subordinates. So working with wetlands and cultural staff. Mm-hmm. And just being in my aunt married a Shoshone, and so a lot of my cousins and family actually live out in Wind River. And there was this interesting dichotomy that I was able to pick up between the Shoshone and the Pawnee, where the Pawnee, we were relocated to Oklahoma, and all of our ancestral homeland is in Nebraska and Kansas, which we're no longer living on. So we'd talk about the good old days back when we were in the Central Plains, but with the Shoshone, they still live in their ancestral homeland, and they live in the Wind Rivers. And so they had this connection to the landscape and had readily available cultural places of significance that they could talk about and go to and show. And that always caught my eye and got me interested. I really didn't get interested into the field of anthropology until I was in the community college. I was just looking to get a liberal arts degree and thought about teaching in history because that was the subject that I was always good at. But I took a historical archaeology course with Dr. David Clark, who primarily works at Catholic University. And that's just kind of where my interest was totally sparked. And I followed up with him the next semester taking a prehistoric archaeology class. And I decided I wanted to be an archaeologist. The community college that I was at did not have an anthropology associates. And so I just within a month, I looked up universities that had programs and I applied to Radford University in late May, just a couple days before the close for admissions. And I was able to get in and that's kind of how it started.
Huh. That is definitely not your standard story, I guess. I mean, that's a really unique experience. Your dad working for the BIA and getting to go out and actually do archaeology and wetland stuff as a kid. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, he was mainly just trying to keep us out of trouble and keep us occupied instead of just sitting at the house all day. But it ended up paying off. And, you know, my younger brother was able to get through the same experience interested in the natural environment as well. But I went with the archaeology and anthropology course.
Yeah. We have listeners, I know, in different parts of the world, and they might not know the basic story behind Oklahoma. So could you give a super, super brief overview of why that is a unique place for indigenous peoples in the U.S.?
Right. So with Indian relocation, a lot of tribes who were in areas that the government wanted people to settle, they would relocate tribes to Oklahoma, which was set up originally as an Indian territory. The entire state was a territory that was kind of sectioned up for different indigenous groups. And after the Indian Wars, the Pawnee Nation actually served as Indian scouts. We actually had the largest amount. We had a full battalion of Pawnee scouts at one point in time. So I think it was like 400 to 600 Pawnees were enlisted to serve the cavalry. But after the Indian Wars were done and Nebraska was just so fertile, we ended up getting relocated to Oklahoma to make way for white settlers. And Oklahoma is not necessarily too far away from Kansas and Nebraska, but it's far enough and it's in a different landscape. It's not proto-historically or prehistorically really ancestral to the northern Caddoan groups like the Arikara and the Pawnee.
Okay. So when it comes to consultation as tribes in Oklahoma, obviously now you have connections to a new place because you're living there and interacting with that landscape on a regular basis. But then you have also these ancestral ties to Kansas and Nebraska. So on a consultation level, how does that work? Do the tribes, I'm assuming, get to consult with both places connected to the more historic landscape as well as their more ancestral, I mean, not ancestral because it's really not that many generations back, but you know what I mean, the previous homelands as well.
Right. So a lot of the consultation that the Pawnee Nation gets to do is through Section 106 legislation. And we're very fortunate that the directors of the state historical societies, so those are like the basically the equivalents of the state historic preservation offices for Kansas and Nebraska. They have a very good relationship with our nation. So Rob Bozell from Nebraska and Robert Horde from Kansas, we have a good relationship with them. And we've always, even before we had our own Tribal Historic Preservation Office, we've had a close connection. So it's fortunate that we have a good relationship with the, you know, the state level governments that deal with archaeology. But our main power to, or not necessarily power, but our main consultation, like I said, comes from Section 106, so state projects and federal projects. Recently, the federal project side is we've had a pretty good relationship, but under the current administration, there's been some wacky things going on that has kind of gotten in the way of some of our the way that the Pawnee Nation advises and how projects should go and where they should go through.
That's, I mean, I'm really glad to hear that you guys, that Kansas and Nebraska have been receptive to having those relationships and that you have good working relationships with them. And it does seem like a lot of the time that tribes that have been removed from their homelands, sometimes the states that they have historic or prehistoric connections to are like, how can this tribe have connections? They're all these, you know, they're not even in the same state. So I'm glad to hear that they have been really receptive to those relationships.
Absolutely. I just wish there was more federal land in those two states. It's mostly private land. So when it comes to, you know, if we could have a relationship with Department of Ag or Department of Interior, but since it's mostly private land, it's unfortunate that most of our ancestral homeland is under, you know, private farmers or townships, and we don't really have much of a say in what goes on there.
Yeah, that's definitely a different challenge than further out west here. Like, you know, in Wyoming, where there's quite a bit of public land.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so let's go back a little bit to your experiences with anthropology in college.
Yeah, so I guess with I actually learned a lot at my community college. Dr. David Clark he taught at the community college system and kind of treated that his classes there is whatever he wanted to do. Whereas what he did with Catholic was much more structured in the university system. But with the community college system, he would get us a lot of hands-on projects. So for my first class that I took, we had to do archive research, which not many people in anthropology as even graduate students have. And I actually did this for my project. I did a land deed search, basically going back for a part in Northern Virginia in near Leesburg, the county seat of Loudoun County, basically just tracing back the lineage of who owned this property. And it was actually phenomenal what I learned just from how the land has changed over time and how it's been used. And then in the next semester, we did a lithic analysis. a pretty easy lithic analysis. But that gave me all this hands-on research. So when I went to Radford, I had a lot more experience than other than people within my cohort, my classes. And I love that department. It's mostly a forensic it's really a forensic anthropology department. The two professors that run the forensic anthropology, Dr. Cliff Boyd and Dr. Donna Boyd, got their degrees from Tennessee. And then the archaeologists there, Dr. Cassidy Urista, Dr. Jake Fox, and Dr. David Anderson, mostly bioarchaeologists, and their experience is mostly European, but it was honestly phenomenal to have such a small department. We got a lot of hands-on work. I was able to do another lithic analysis there under Dr. Cliff Boyd. And through that work, I actually presented research as an undergrad at the SAAs in San Francisco.
Nice.
And really got exposed to the broader archaeological community through them. And I was able to have a lot of free reign in undergrad. I actually made a decent amount of these for projects, these parody rap videos, which we parodied, me and a buddy parodied popular songs at the time and made them archaeological content and turned them in as projects. And the professors really didn't know what to do with it, but they really enjoyed them.
Do you have those on YouTube or anything?
Yeah, they are. I think you just got a, it's under the name Inebriated Archaeology. That was the group that we created. So there's a bunch, and I actually continued doing those through my master's. But the most significant experience that I had in undergraduate was I took a course on chiefdoms by Dr. David Anderson. And through that, I learned about the Caddoan chiefdom culture. And Pawnee and Arikara and the Wichita were part of the Caddoan language family. So the prominent groups are the Caddo proper, which are in Oklahoma, Arikara, Pawnee, and then the Wichita. And there's a couple others. So that always kind of caught my eye because they were in Oklahoma. And I was talking with Dr. Anderson. I said, well, we have, from my understanding is from what the tribe's understanding is that where we came, that we're ancestors of the Mayans, and he's a Mayatologist. And as politely as he could, he told me that's not true. That can't be possible. And that really kind of got my wheels turning in my head as to where did the Pawnee come from? Mm-hmm. And I would talk to family members, and there was always this, for some reason, there was this prevalence of, well, we're related to the Maya. And I have no idea where that came from. Well, I didn't at the time. Now I have a pretty good idea of who started that. But that's kind of where my interest started really becoming, because I thought as an undergrad that the archaeological record must be pretty well known and someone must have done this research into Pawnee and Arikara origins. And that is really not the case, as I found in my graduate career.
Really?
Yeah. There have been a handful of people that have postulated the prehistoric origins of the Pawnee, but it was just a handful of people.
Okay.
So that's kind of where that got started, was just asking this question to a professor as, well, we've heard this, is this possible? And him politely saying no.
And what did you find?
Well, that was my master's work. And so before coming out, and this, when I, between my master's and undergraduate, I worked on a CRM project. And I was always just talking to my crew, and they told me, hey, you should start researching what you want to do for your master's now. Get a head start on it. And I'm really grateful for that advice, because that summer I just spent time after work just doing research and then formulating a thesis and a hypothesis.
Right.
I came across, I was just kind of Googling who else has done something like this. And I came across a blog by Roger Echohawk, Floating Worlds. And Roger is the brother of Walter Echohawk, who did a lot of indigenous legislation back during NAGPRA. Mm-hmm. And Roger has his master's in history, and an archaeologist, Dr. Douglas Bamforth, was on his committee. And actually, Dr. Bamforth is my doctorate advisor. So it kind of came full circle, and I met up with Roger. He actually lives in Colorado. So when I moved out to Wyoming for my master's, I had actually met up with him once a month, and we just sat down and talked. And he gave me all these resources and introduced me to the oral histories and the oral traditions of the Pawnee and Arikara, because he's been doing that for his life, is going through and finding the original texts that were written in the 1800s and tracking down these records. So through him, I was just given this mass amount of data. And I thought, well, we should look at the oral traditions and the oral histories. Where do the Pawnee and Arikara say they came from? And through that, I was just piecing together the archaeological record. There had been a decent amount of material written tying the Pawnee and Arikara to the initial coalescent variant in the Central Plains tradition.
Okay, wait, I don't know what that is.
So, absolutely. So, these are archaeological cultures within the Central Plains. So there you have historic Arikara, which is called extended coalescent variant or post-contact coalescent variant, depending on the time frame. And you have Pawnee, which is just historic Pawnee archaeology or lower loop archaeology. And before that, in that same region, you have these archaeological cultures that existed from 900 AD to about 1450. And you have the initial coalescent variant and Central Plains tradition. And so they're in the same geographic landscape as the historic Pawnee and Arikara. Mm-hmm. And I use these oral traditions about this southeastern migration, or there's some oral traditions from the Skeedy that tied the formation or ethnogenesis of the Skeedy Pawnee in along Wild Licorice Creek, which is in the center of one of the Central Plains tradition phases. And another one from the South Bands, we call them in the Pawnee, that tie them in southeast Nebraska along near the Missouri River. So it was this really fun puzzle of looking at the known archaeological record and what other people have been talking about in terms of the relationship between these archaeological cultures with these historic tribes, and using the oral traditions to understand the archaeology.
Oh, okay. So, okay. Basically, did you find that the Arikara were connected to that previous archaeology group?
Yes, I believe so. And that's where the Bayesian and some of these mathematical packages that I use to help tie in a lot of this data with the archaeological record and the oral traditions. Huh. So I firmly believe that the Central Plains tradition and initial coalescent variant are these ancestral cultures to the Pawnee, Arikara, and also most likely the Wichita, but I really haven't looked at the Wichita quite extensively yet.
Yeah. Okay. So again, I feel like there's a lot of times there's this case where people are like, oh, this one piece of technology changed. It's a totally different group of people.
And right.
Once again, we're seeing that is not the case. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, on that note, we are at our first break point. So we will be back in a minute.
Hey, everybody. Chris Webster here to talk about one of our affiliate programs. Affiliates are partnerships with the Archaeology Podcast Network, where if you purchase their service, they give us a little bit of a kickback. And one of the ones we're talking about today is great for archaeologists or anybody that wants a little bit of extra income. And that's what we call a side hustle in cultural resource management archaeology. So head on over to arcpodnet.com/sidehustle. And you see a little write-up about what we're talking about. This one is all about digital marketing. So when you click on the link, it'll take you over to Seth Himes' website for a free mini course on how to get a career in digital marketing. Now, for you people out there that just want something temporary, you don't have to get a career. You can still get clients, and Seth shows you how to do that. So again, head on over to arcpodnet.com/sidehustle to link you into this free course, which can take you to the paid course if you like it enough and you want to keep on going. But take the free one first and check that out and make a little bit of extra cash today while you're between jobs or working in a hotel room or something like that, and you just want a little extra time. So again, that's arcpodnet.com/sidehustle. Hey, Chris Webster, back one more time. Our final ad for this ad break is to talk about the membership plans for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We're always striving to be a listener-supported network, and we want you to have a little hand in what we're doing here. So we've got three different membership levels: supporting member at $5 a month or $42 a year, standard member at $10 a month or $84 per year, and professional member at $20 per month or $168 per year. And what do you get for all those? Well, at the lowest membership, at the supporting member, you get an APN sticker, you get high quality and early downloads from us, so you get the episodes as soon as they're edited. As a standard member, you get all that, plus a members-only Slack team where you can communicate with our show hosts and other members. You get 5 stickers, a store discount, bonus content, and some early downloads. As a professional member, you get all that stuff, plus a coffee mug, a t-shirt, or whatever swag I have at the time. Usually it's a couple of those things. You get to be part of a podcast focus group to discuss new shows. You'll get our extra learning content and Team Black content for free. Team Black is going to be a subscriber-based website here shortly, but you will get the content for free. So check that out over at arcpodnet.com/members and support archaeological education and outreach today. Thank you. Now back to the show.
All right. And we are back. Okay. So I want to back up a second. So we were at your master's, but I want to back up a second and go back towards your CRM experience, because that is something that we had a listener specifically ask about, was just trying to get hear more perspectives from CRM archaeologists. And to the listener out there, we are still working on that, and we are hoping to get some more people that are specifically working for CRM firms. We know that we haven't been able to do that so far, but it's probably going to be a little bit. So in the meantime, Carlton, if you could talk a little bit about your experience working for the CRM firm.
Absolutely. So I did a couple CRM projects through Radford University under Cliff Boyd, just little projects around the town of Radford. But when I graduated with my BS, I was looking for work before I went to get my master's. And there happened to be a project going on in the same area that I was already living in. And a former graduate of Radford University was on that project, and who I was pretty familiar with. I reached out to him. He got me in contact, and I was able to get a job as a science aide for the Mountain Valley Pipeline project that was going through Virginia and West Virginia. And it was definitely a really good and enlightening experience. So this was East Coast CRM. So that's a lot of shovel bumming. You know, you're digging a hole every 10 meters. So it's not like some of the experiences here in the West, where you're doing a lot of hiking and ground survey. This was a lot of digging. I had a lot of fun, and I made some really good connections. And mostly I learned a lot from the crew, because they've been doing it for a long time, and a lot of them had masters. So I would talk to them about their experience in graduate school, and they gave me some really good advice on what to do and what not to do and how to get a jump start on my master's. And what I learned really quickly from my experience, that CRM work isn't necessarily, if you're just a basic shovel bum, it's not really science. You're there to do work. It's a job, and you're there to bust out holes, and you're there to get a job done. And what was really unfortunate while doing that work, that pipeline, of course, was heavily protested. And personally, I can say that I wasn't a big fan of the pipeline itself, but under federal law, archaeologists have to go out and, you know, survey to see if there's anything of cultural significance in the way of some of these pipelines. But we had protesters. We would get stopped by the sheriff. So there was days that we basically were kicked off of what we were supposed to do that day. Or angry landowners was a big one. My first day on the job, we had had a guy come out and yell at us and ask us what we were doing on his property. Yeah, so it was an interesting experience. But I like more, personally, I like more of the research side of things. I really like getting into the literature. I really like solving research problems, which you can do with CRM reports and a lot of that gray literature. But as a science aide, you're really not doing that. You're just there to bust out holes.
So did you feel like having that CRM experience, and obviously you got, I mean, really quality experience as an undergrad as well, do you feel like that helped you with your master's and your PhD?
Absolutely. Just being able to talk to other people on the crew, as well as the field directors and the project directors who, you know, had upper level degrees, and just being able to pick their brains about what got them into archaeology and how they got through graduate school. But the biggest advice that they gave me was, you know, start working on a question now over the summer before you even get to your master's. Like, think of something you want to do, because if you're show up and you're not sure what you want to do, that's time wasted as a graduate student not looking into a problem. So I was able to come up with in the field, just, I want to look at Pawnee and Arikara and archaeological ancestry. And I wanted to do that. And I was already pulling up, looking at articles and pulling out resources. So by the time I got to Wyoming, I had an idea. I was able to get Dr. Robert Kelly as my advisor, and I got my thesis committee within a month of getting to the department and working on my thesis. So I was really motivated to get all that done, while I had some colleagues who were still struggling to find a project. And when you're trying to get done in 2 years, time is key.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, I went into grad school with a topic and a project based on a previous project that I had worked on in undergrad, and ended up going in a completely opposite direction. But I do think that going in and having an idea and something that you want to pursue really does take out some of the anxiety, and I don't know, it just sets you up better. Like, even if you end up realizing that you need to switch, mm-hmm. it still puts you, it starts you out on a much more solid footing for sure.
Absolutely.
Okay. So Wyoming, and then how did you end up at Boulder?
I thought I was going to stay at Wyoming. When I originally applied there, I wanted to do my PhD and master's there all in one go. But it was actually through Roger Echohawk. He introduced me to Dr. Bamforth from CU Boulder during one of our monthly meetings, where we just sat down and talked about resources and kind of where I was going to go with my career. And I had no idea who Dr. Bamforth was, which is a shame. My thesis advisor, Dr. Kelly, he's known Dr. Bamforth since they were 18 working in Gatecliff. So he was able to give me an idea. And I got to sit down and chat with Dr. Bamforth about this project that he's doing in Nebraska on a initial coalescent variant site, so an ancestral Pawnee and Arikara site. And we just kind of got to talking, and I wanted to work with him in the field. I met with him at the Plains Conference about a year later, or a couple months later, I guess. And just talking with him and understanding his research interests, things started to click. And when I was applying for graduate programs, I asked if, you know, he'd be interested. And we sat down and really, he looked over my master's work and it just fit. And he's a pretty experienced plains archaeologist. Most of his work was done with paleoarchaeology in the plains, but he got bored of it. And now he works on early farmers in the Great Plains. And so that's why I came to Boulder. Wasn't to be in Boulder or to be in Colorado. It was just to work with Doug.
So are you still, well, I guess, first of all, did you end up doing oral history work? Did you end up going and doing ethnographic interviews? I'm an ethnographer myself. I'm a cultural anthropologist by training. Even though I work in CRM, I'm actually not an archaeologist. I'm a cultural anthropologist in CRM. So obviously, when you said that you were talking about oral traditions and oral history, that obviously really sparked my interest. So I'd love to hear if you ended up doing interviews or if that's something that you're still looking at doing, tying into the archaeology side you were just talking about.
Absolutely. So most of the data that came from the oral histories came from Roger Echohawk's collection, the work that he's been doing for the past 30 years and collecting a lot of the original documentation that George Hyde, Weltfish did, and some of those early anthropologists that came out in the late 1800s. I tried to do my own ethnographic research, but even just talking to my dad and my uncles who couldn't agree on things that happened in their own childhood, to get my master's done in time, I figured I'm just going to rely on the written record of the oral histories mm-hmm. that have been taken down. So I didn't do much work with living tribal members. Of course, I talked with tribal elders. But the fact that this story of being related to the Maya continued to pop up really had me concerned. Later on, I found a book. It's Archaeology of the Soul. I think it's by Robert Hall. And he looks mm-hmm. at a lot of these traditions. And in one of the chapters, he's looking at a Skeety tradition about human sacrifice. And he relates it to the Maya and said, this must be a Maya or Aztec ritual. Therefore, they must be related somehow. And that caught on in the Pawnee and Arikara community. So is this anthropologist interpretation, just this one anthropologist interpretation that has taken over the mindset of where these two tribes came from? And it's through my research, it's highly unlikely. I think there's no real correlation between these two groups other than they practice human sacrifice. And even the way they practice it was completely different. So I just kind of, for my dissertation work that I'm doing now, I'm going to have more involvement through some of what the community has to say. But for the master's, based on that time scale, I really just wanted to use the literature.
So how are you going to incorporate it when it comes to your PhD?
We have, the Pawnee Nation has the Nisharu Council, so our Council of Elders. And now that I'm working with the board and the tribal government, well, I'm just going to go to Oklahoma and just sit down with a bunch of members of the community and just ask them questions about what their families has said, what they think, and try to build upon that. But a lot of it still is going to be based on the early accounts that the oral traditions, the oral history said. And it's hard. I know our tribe went from several thousand upwards of 20,000 to 600. The variation in cultural knowledge and practice and tradition, I mean, is effectively, it's not as large as it used to be. So we've lost a lot of variation. We've lost a lot of history. So whatever surviving fragments we have, they're all important at this point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did not fare well under the epidemics, being a farming society that was close together. Those things really took a toll on our nations.
That's like 3% or something. I mean, that's...
Yeah, it's not much. So out of there's the Skeedy, which is what I am, there was 13 major clans that in those villages were several hundred lodges, thousands of people, and now there's only one that exists. The other ones were wiped out or incorporated into the last clan. With that perspective, I have to acknowledge the fact that there's some things that I'll never be able to know, and maybe some of these stories that have survived might just be familial stories or things that might not necessarily have been the pervasive accepted story in prehistoric times. So it's difficult, and I have to always be cautious of my own tribal oral histories, because what has survived and what hasn't. And it's tough. And some members of the community don't like to hear that, when it's like, well, how can we test the validity of these things? And even then, you know, it's not necessarily possible.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you next is what do you do in that kind of situation where what you find is maybe not necessarily what you wanted to find, or that is going to sit well with the community that you're working with? How do you approach that? And I mean, I guess, like, to me, I can see why the Maya would be like a story that people would want to connect to, because, you know, it's a very like well-known, powerful group that, you know, I get that. But at the same time, what you're talking about, what you found in your research showing this deep connection to the landscape, that's also a powerful story. What have you found for navigating that challenge?
Absolutely. So my biggest one is, of course, deconstructing that Maya origin. And a lot of it actually has to do with deconstructing the romanticism of American Indians as these people that were in touch with the landscape, and really showing the archaeology back to the community. Like, listen, just because we're not part of the Maya doesn't mean we weren't great. If you look at the history of our people as being the first farmers into this area, bringing corn into here and being a part of these vast economic systems with Cahokia, the chiefdoms, and the Southwest, that we have a better story to tell, having our own identity and our own agency within the Central Plains. We don't need to be related to some powerful group to make us look better or to feel better about ourselves as a people, when we've been in the plains for hundreds of years and bringing villages, bringing corn, bringing a different way of life here and continuing that way of life, but also being connected with among the landscape with other groups and being a part of these. You know, we have those massive buffalo jump kills in the Great Plains, and this network between woodland people or hunter-gatherers with the socially stratified communities in the Southeast and Cahokia, that we were these, a sense, we could, middlemen between these groups, where you would come to our villages along the Missouri River, along the rivers, and we would take it down to Cahokia. Mm. So it's my success has relied on, look at who we are as a people and what we've become and have adapted to. You know, we've overcome massive droughts and climate change, the medieval warming period, which had an effect prehistorically, and that the story of our people doesn't need to be tied into the story of someone in Mesoamerica right. to make us be proud of who we are, that we have a storied history here in the Great Plains and in the Southeast. that's, you know, makes us us, and we don't need to rely on anybody else.
I can imagine it would still be a challenge, though, but that people don't like to hear that what their grandparents told them is doesn't match up with the science.
Absolutely. And that's always difficult, especially being an archaeologist. And I never grew up in Pawnee, Oklahoma. I've only visited. So it's kind of being seen as an outsider from two different perspectives, both academically and just kind of not growing up in the community. But everyone's been really respectful and polite. I think I do a pretty good job at explaining myself and not coming across as a snobby academic who says it's wrong. I break down Robert Hall's book and I'm like, this is the age that your grandparents were alive that he went out and told everybody. But like, here are our own oral histories that don't talk about jungles or the Maya or anything. Like, this is what, you know, our ancestors said, your great grandparents, great great grandparents said. And this is just Rob Hall and this is what he said. And of course, not trying to diss Rob Hall or anything. His work, he's done absolutely phenomenal work. I just think that one interpretation needed some more supporting evidence.
All right. We are at a good stopping point for our second segment. So we're going to put you on a break real quick and we'll be right back.
Hey, everybody. Chris Webster here. I have one more affiliate to talk to you about, and it's called Timular. Timular is an 8-sided cube. I've actually got one myself. I love it. It's amazing. It helps me track 8 different tasks that I do from different companies, from podcast editing to working for WildNote, doing different things with them. And then time tracking is also amazing as well. You can actually just use the Timular app for free if you want. But if you want some real visual time tracking, you just flip the cube. Flip the cube and you do a new task and you can assign the cube to any sides that you want. And the great thing is it's attached to the internet. So if you start on your phone, you can stop on your computer, you can change tasks on your tablet, you know, wherever you're using Timular. So check it out, arcpodnet.com/Timular for our affiliate link. That's arcpodnet.com/Timular, TimeuLar. So check that out and track your time accurately today. Now back to the show.
All right. And we are back from our break. So I do want to move forward and talk about where you see yourself going in the future and all of that good stuff. But real quick, before we do that, there was one more thing on your CV that you sent that I'm just really personally curious about. So it's the caloric return experimental study. Could you talk about that a little?
Yes, absolutely. That was under the project leader was Dr. Eric Robinson from the University of Wyoming in partnership with Dr. Lizbeth Lauterbach, I think I'm saying that right, from the University of Utah. And what the study was aiming to do was to bring to collect biscuit root. I have no idea what the scientific name of it is, using digging sticks. So a prehistoric method of collecting tubers. So we went out to the Red Desert in Wyoming in the middle of June to time ourselves how long it took us within like a 30-minute or an hour window, how much biscuit root we could collect, and then how many calories that would in turn give us to figure out if this was a plausible means of supporting yourself on the landscape in between, you know, Utah and the Wind Rivers. First problem was biscuit root was not in season, so finding it was difficult. We were able to find some and actually have some, and it tasted a lot like carrots. It was pretty good. And the second one was a personal issue where I treated this like spring break and went out there with a tank top and 6-inch shorts and got second-degree sunburn on my shoulders and back, and that was not fun at all, and I'm still getting teased by it from Dr. Robinson. For that. And I believe in one of his letters of recommendation, he talked about that. But, you know, day two, even with all that sunburn, I went back out into the field, weren't able to find any. But it was really fun just to kind of do a study that didn't involve necessarily archaeological digging, just kind of going out there like, okay, can we see if people are supporting themselves on the landscape? And I don't know what the results of that study were, but being able to do an experimental project when I had nothing else going on during that time was pretty fun to get out there and check out the Red Desert and be in places that I hadn't been before. Sunburn, I could have gone without, but it's for a good story.
Well, and hopefully they got to go out there when it actually wasn't season. Get a little bit more of a sense of whether that worked or not.
Right. Yeah. I think it's in the works to go back out there at some point when it's in season. But as of now, nothing scheduled.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. All right. So Well, we've talked about, you know, what got you interested in archaeology and your undergrad and grad work. Where do you want to take all this?
I have so many ideas. It's hard to juggle them all. I would like to continue to stay in academia. I love teaching. I love doing my own research. But I also still want to continue to support the tribe. So working with the Tribal Historic Preservation Office, our TIPO is Matt Reed from Oklahoma. And I think he has a degree in museum studies, who's also on the museum board that I'm on. And really trying to expand our office to include a tribal archaeologist, either it's part-time or full-time. I would still love to continue working with the nation and kind of opening up are what we see as culturally relative. And, you know, a lot of other tribes are getting archaeologists and having these bigger expanded departments. And I would love to see the Pawnee Nation in particular kind of expand itself outside of just a NAGPRA coordinator and outside of a TIPO, but also bring in cultural anthropologists, linguistic anthropologists, and archaeologists. We have two amazing guys. I'm struggling to remember their names at the moment, but they're linguistic anthropologists who got their master's from Oklahoma, and their work is in the Pawnee language, and they're actually bringing back our language. And I hate the word revitalization. I like the term renaissance better. So bringing a linguistic renaissance back to the tribe and teaching these classes. And I would love it if the tribe would incorporate them within our cultural resources division. And so we could have a more anthropological oriented department that could really support the tribe, especially in administrations like this or just in the future, where we're really starting to lose our generation that went to the Indian schools, where some of the grandchildren or children of those that were removed to Oklahoma.
Mm, yeah, those would be really important oral histories for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah, that's obviously a really heartbreaking and, I mean, devastating. There's not really a good word for what that experience would be like, but it's also, you know, there's a lot of resilience in how people have adapted after those kinds of experiences. And it's, you know, like there's groups that are still going to be facing those types of issues. Like we had a woman, Tina Steggy, she's an anthropologist from the Marshall Islands, and she was looking at this exact same question of, okay, well, we're about to face removal from our homelands, and, you know, what can we learn from others that have experienced the same experience, and what can we, like, how can we be proactive in what we're facing? So maybe there's, you know, I don't want to say like turn something like that into a positive, because something like that is just, it's horrible. It's not supposed to be a positive, but yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting thing to look at, I guess.
No, absolutely. And I tie it back into, you know, archaeologically and prehistorically how the Pawnee and Arikara have overcome challenge. And this is just another challenge, that this removal from Nebraska and Kansas doesn't define us as nations. It's just part of our history and we've overcome it before, and it's just making the best of the situation. You know, being stuck in the past isn't going to be productive in making sure the future for the nations is positive.
Yeah. And I mean, growing the department, the TIPO office, like you're talking about, and having it be able to, like you mentioned, there's not a ton of state and federal land in your more traditional homelands. So there's less Section 106 and NAGPRA and things like that to deal with. But so maybe that's an opportunity to be really proactive in what the community wants to see.
Exactly.
So before we move forward, while we're on the Pawnee Nation part of the conversation, let's talk about the museum and what it's been like being on the board of directors. Well, let's start with that.
So I, this is going to be really embarrassing. I've never been to the museum.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was funded and created after I was in undergrad. And it's been a bit since I've been back to Pawnee, Oklahoma. But I saw a call on the Pawnee Nation website for board member positions, and I applied and had an interview with the tribal council. And it was an interesting interview for sure. They really liked my record. Their main concern was that I didn't have much family in Pawnee, Oklahoma. And I think their primary concern was, is he too academic? Is he not part of the community?
Right.
But I sold it pretty good. I was like, well, if there's six of us on this committee and you have five people who are very much in touch with the community and live with it, it's okay to have a sixth person to bring a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh yeah, well that makes sense. So got voted on, and it's been a really positive experience. Our NAGPRA coordinator, Maggie Rice, and our TIPO, Matt Reed, are also on the board. My uncle, who is the director of our cultural division, he doesn't sit on the board, but he monitors it. And then I've got to know a couple other key members of the community. And we recently just had a new board member. She has she works with museums, digital collections. And all of our experiences, it's just really awesome to sit down, or I guess over a phone call, talk with these people. Matt has his experience with the Oklahoma Archaeological Society, or Historical Society, sorry. And he's worked with museums his entire life and career. And so being on that board and trying to figure out what's going on with the museum, because the museum is pretty new and there's not much in it. And it's not well funded by the tribe. I think we got our funding cut again, so we don't really have a budget. So it's this really fun struggle of us think tanking, trying to figure out what can we bring to this museum, what can we show the Pawnee Nation, and how are we trying to portray ourselves? So a lot of times everyone wants to go with historic context. Let's talk about the Indian Wars. Let's talk about the Pawnee Scouts, or let's do an art exhibit on some of these paintings from this time. And my thought is always, let's talk about the prehistoric. Let's talk about let's show the tribe and the nation a part of their past that they're not really familiar with. So a lot of that comes down to just trying to get exhibits, honestly, is just such a struggle. We don't necessarily have the backing. We have the official backing of the tribal council. But if the money keeps disappearing, how are we supposed to support a museum with these limited resources? And it's hard. So it's really fun being in this grassroots, just trying to build the foundations for this museum and trying to come up with ideas, or just scrounge up display cases, or come up with these ideas. Like, what do we show the tribe? And it can be frustrating at times. And our TIPO, Matt Reed, has been really supportive. You know, he's reached out to me. It's like, hey, I know you're getting frustrated with the lack of progress, but just keep it up. You know, it's going to get better. We just got to keep fighting. And it's honestly just trying to show the community that there's value in a museum or a cultural center. I don't think we've really defined a name for it yet. I think it's officially the Pawnee Nation Museum, but I think we're leaning towards cultural center now. And I've been trying to, I would love to go down there and have an archaeology weekend and have atlatl throwing and pot making and all this other, you know, fun hands-on activities, yeah, and like flint napping. I have a lot of that through Wyoming has an archaeology day. And they have a fair at the state historic, the territorial prison. And you would think it's probably this podunk thing, but they have thousands of people come. And they have the Wind River dancers show up. They have storytellers from the Arapaho and Shoshone show up. An atlatl range that has a Russ Adams. I think his name is Russ Adams. He has a foam mammoth that he brings out there, and it's pretty large. Everyone loves throwing at it. So to try to do something for the community and get them interested, and just like the hands-on aspect, I think that's the value in archaeology. If you can put a piece of pottery or a projectile point in someone's hand, and that's your living history right there. To make that tangible connection to the past, That's what matters. And I think my nation is really lacking that. And especially since we're not on our ancestral homeland, just even have a connection to these places of significance is hard. So just starting with putting our history in the hands of our people, I think that's an important first step. Because it's something I think about on an archaeological dig when I'm sitting there in northeast Nebraska at an initial coalescent variant site, and I'm at a trash pit. And I can hold a stone pipe, and I can see where someone messed up on it and threw it away. And you're like, wow, that's a 700-year-old oopsie. And you can read that. Like that's living history. You can see somebody's decisions in the past. And I think the museum has this awesome opportunity to provide that to the nation. Like, you know, we're not this period of relocation isn't the downfall of our nation. Like, we shouldn't be sorry for ourselves. And it's actually kind of funny because through my research, it looks like before people were in the Central Plains, they were in Oklahoma and Arkansas and that side of the river. So it's, you know, it's a 1,000-year-old homecoming, but they don't know that. So that's what I think the importance of this museum is really just trying to show these different views of our past that the tribe isn't necessarily aware of anymore, to show these connections with the landscape and other tribes. What was our role? What did we do 600 years ago, 1,000 years ago? What were we doing and how were we interacting? And who were we? So it's an important first step, and it's going to be a hard one to get the funding to do it. But that's the goal with the museum, is its own cultural renaissance for the tribe, to have them see prehistorically who we were. It's always fun to think about the Indian Wars and everything that we did for the cavalry and our role in fighting the Cheyenne, Arapaho, and the Siouan groups. But there's more to us than just being scouts for the military or being part of the Euro-American narrative.
That makes sense. So we're talking about how you would like the Pawnee story to be told in the future through this museum. What about where would you like to see the stories in anthropology, I guess, go in the future? Like, how would you change the field if you could?
Change the field. I don't know if I can necessarily change the field, but definitely help with attitudes. I think every anthropologist should read Chip Colwell's book, Plundered Skulls and Stolen Spirits. Mm-hmm. That should be a must. It's through Chip works at the Denver Museum, and it's through his experiences with NAGPRA and repatriation and talking about how NAGPRA came to fruition and these experiences through the Smithsonian and with the tribes. And it does a really good job at bringing together the viewpoints of government, the nation's archaeologists and museums, and humanizing that experience. I think NAGPRA was a pretty big paradigm shift in the fields of museums and anthropology. And of course, like the cliche is everything is built on trust and understanding, which is absolutely true. But I think my personal experience with how tribes treat archaeologists and anthropologists can be very domineering in the aspect if tribes don't get the research they want to hear, they dismiss it. And with that, they dismiss the archaeologists or the researcher. It can be very my way or the highway. And of course, when we're talking about over 560 federally recognized tribes, pigeonholing how every tribal government deals with research is ludicrous. And of course, I'm not trying to do that, but I'm pretty firm of the perspective that just because someone, a researcher, has a different opinion, doesn't mean that you should run them out of town. To accept it and to not only just accept it, but to honestly promote it. Like, I know some tribal groups, if anthropologist or archaeologist doesn't come to them first and get permission, which of course you absolutely should, and if they do research, then they just don't even talk about their work or what they've done, instead of using it as a learning experience or a teaching tool of like, this is what this researcher did. They didn't come to us first. This is what they got wrong, right? And this is what they've gotten right. But to use these as teaching tools, I mean, this is all conversation between tribes, museums, and archaeologists. I mean, archaeologists who work in North America, they're interested in the indigenous past. And I think it's tribes need to really utilize the passion and the experiences of a lot of these experts or people that are wanting to become experts to our benefit. And just to not be so, I wouldn't say narrow-minded, but to be more accepting of alternative viewpoints. You don't have to like them. You don't have to believe that they're right, but to be accepting of them. If we really want a dialogue to exist, an open and beneficial dialogue between all these different interest groups, the respect has to go two ways. And so does the understanding. And when you're dealing with science, people aren't always going to agree. And there's nothing wrong with that. But as long as that conversation and dialogue is respectful, that's what matters most. You know, I have no problem with someone, another archaeologist, telling me that my work is completely wrong. Just prove, give me the data, and let's talk about it.
Okay, well, we are at the end already. So do you have anything that you wanted to close out with, or anything where people, did you want to send people anywhere for more information on anything you discussed?
I can send you some stuff in the show notes, and the people can look it up there.
Sounds good. Anything, any final thoughts? You good?
No, thank you very much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. And I really like where your podcast is going, and just to keep up the good work.
All right. Well, thank you. And thank you for coming on and sharing with all of us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Heritage Voices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Music Store. Also, if you like the show, please share with your friends or write us a review. If you have any questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org, or you can find me on Facebook through Living Heritage Anthropology, or on Twitter @LivingHeritageA. As always, thank you to Lyle Blanqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.